There are a lot of constants to gardening. You're choosing the right plants. You need to do that for your growing conditions. You got to keep them watered and fed and weed-free. But, you know, it's really worth it when you can relax and enjoy the fruits and the flowers and the veggies of your labors. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Today, we are lucky to have back Ed Lyon. Ed is the director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus. And he's been with us many times to talk about gardens on Garden Talk and a little about Allen Centennial Gardens. And, Ed, great to see you again.
Oh, it's great to be here.
I love it. And the gardens are looking wonderful, the Allen Gardens.
We think they look as good as they ever have. We're very pleased this year.
They're very, very beautiful. Well, we have, and I guess maybe it's a good growing year then.
It has been, and sort of limited issues, which is great. Certainly, we could use a little rain right now, but it's not anything, you know, dramatic. We can always water. Japanese beetles have been quite limited this year. We haven't seen any major powdery mildew or fungal issues. So, yeah, it's been a pretty good year.
There, I think when people think of a botanical garden, they think of flowers and woody ornamentals, but in some gardens, you can incorporate vegetables, and you've done that over at the Allen Centennial Gardens.
Actually, that's become a very large section of the gardens. We call it, it used to be the vegetable garden, and now it's called the edible garden. And not only are we doing a large number of them, and we also have a section for small fruits and other items, but we've gotten very heavily into demonstrating the limited space gardening for folks. And we must have, I bet, at least 20 different ways to show people how they can take plants vertical or grow things in containers. The new thing in container production are fruits that have been bred that you can harvest that grow well in containers. Some of the tomatoes and vining crops have been selected for containers as well. So we demonstrate a large number of ways to do vegetable gardening in small space and some of the new vegetables and fruits that are out.
And it's, you know, it is fun to look at gorgeous gardens like you have at Allen and say, oh, I'm never going to be able to do that. But I think there's a lot to be learned, as you're talking about, from going, visiting a garden like Allen.
Oh, absolutely. And I agree. And one of my goals has been, we're a small garden to begin with, so it's a little easier for us. But some of the things I've done in the 6 years that I've been there is to segment areas down because we know if it looks too vast and too imposing, the homeowner is going to say, oh, well, that looks gorgeous, but I can't do that at home. And we also try to make things not so fancy, if you will. Yeah. I mean, there's things that we have there, our square foot gardening beds you could build for less than $25. So because our primary mission is to be a teaching garden, we try to demonstrate things in ways that we think the homeowner can say, hey, I can do this. I can take this idea home with me.
And you're really succeeding. You know, there's one variety that you have that's relatively new to a lot of gardeners, at least, is getting a lot of attention now. Orient pets?
The orient pet lilies. And right now they're gaining a lot of attention in the gardens. Some of the lilies have gone past their peak and others have yet to bloom. But right now at the gardens, there are masses and masses of bloom on lilies. And a few years ago, I discovered it's not a species. It's a hybrid cross that they're calling Orien Pet. So it's O-R-I-E-N-P-E-T, sort of an odd name, but it's a whole division of lilies. They crossed the old regal lilies, which were the great big tall trumpet lilies with fragrance, with a couple of other species. And what I love about them is they get tall, but they have very strong, rigid stems. In fact, yesterday some folks from Ohio were in, and they're like, how in the world do you get those big stems on your lilies? And they were doing the old oriental lilies. And they're very rigid and just loaded with great, big, huge, many, many blooms that are still fragrant. And if you were to walk into the gardens today, they're right at the entrance. The fragrance is almost overwhelming. But everybody's been noticing them. I only do Orion pets in my own garden and in the sunny areas myself now. And there's a large number of cultivars out there. I found a wonderful online nursery in, I believe they're in Washington. It's called B&D Lilies. I shouldn't say that because I haven't placed my order yet. And now everybody's going to run out and order. But their selection is tremendous. Very large, good-sized bulbs. That's one thing you want to look for in lilies. A lot of lilies that are sold through mail order may not be as large, and excellent pricing. So I would say we might have close to 40, maybe 50 different lilies right now. And I encourage people, if you really want to see lilies at their best, make the trip in and take a look at them right now, because they'll knock your socks off.
Oh, man. That's wonderful. Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens. By the way, we have a link and a nice photo of the gardens on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And certainly it's right on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. Handily enough, especially if you're coming on a weekend, there's parking right across the street, covered parking.
And one of the biggest challenges to get people to come and see us is they think that they're going to be ticketed if they come in on any day.
Yeah.
And obviously, on weekends, you can park pretty much anywhere.
Yeah.
Unless it's a football Saturday, of course.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And early evenings. A lot of people think, oh, well, I can't go onto campus. And that's one of the nicest times to come in and see the gardens.
Oh, absolutely. Terry in Green Bay has a question. Hi, Terry. Thank you for calling.
Yes, good morning. I'd like to ask Ed a question and make a comment, and this is in regards to the use of chicken grits. You know, the granule, small granite that's crushed up. I know in some of Larry's past shows, people made a comment about salt damage. What I use when we get iced on, sidewalks or driveways, is I get the dark colored chicken grit throw out rather than
salt.
Yeah, that's an excellent idea. There's a number of options. Some people use kitty litter, although that gets kind of mushy. But there are several different options to use. Certainly, we try to avoid salt wherever we can, because salt does tremendous damage to plant materials.
Right, right. And I'd like to ask, Ed, we're going to be transplanting some succulents into pots. And I think I heard one time you can use like part chicken grit and part something else. What was that something else that would be another good planting medium?
Well, we would use a combination, and we have a massive rock garden at Allen Centennial Gardens. So we actually make mixes for succulents, and then we would probably do the same thing in a pot. But the mix that we use is half sand, and when I say sand, we're talking a very coarse torpedo sand or builder sand.
Okay.
We use a quarter compost, because they do need a little bit of compost, not a lot, and then a quarter pea gravel. And so we'll have that mix made up for our rock garden plants, and once the succulents are planted in it, then we use just straight pea gravel as a top mulch. Most succulents, you want to keep them good and dry around the base of their crown, or they will rot out. So we mulch rock garden plants or succulents with something like a pea gravel, unlike what we would do with perennials.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the mix that we use. Now, chicken grit, I don't have a lot of experience with that. I'm certainly...
Probably could work.
Yeah, I would think that it would work in place of the gravel. But certainly sand and a little bit of compost and there would be beneficial to the plants as well.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Terry, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Paul in Watertown a chance to join us. Paul, hello to you.
Hello. How are you guys?
Great. Appreciate your call.
Good. Thanks. Great shows. I love this. And I have a lot of garden going on. I got all kinds of plants. But I sent Larry an email of a picture. I have Yukon Gold potatoes. And I've got, looks like berries growing off of the plants, off the flowers. They look like small tomatoes. And I've never seen this on my potatoes before. I don't know if you got the email from Jenny.
Oh, let's see. I don't have it right this minute.
Okay. Well, she sent it, so, well, anyways, I did hear that you cross tomatoes and potatoes, but I didn't cross anything. These were just a pile of yucca. It's on Facebook.
Yeah, and actually they don't cross a potato with a tomato. What they've done, and it's rather interesting, is that what they'll do is they'll graft a potato and tomato together because they are actually so closely related.
Now I've got it up.
Yeah, but it doesn't surprise me that you see some type of a fruit, and it may look tomato-like because they are so closely related, but it's a flower. And flowers eventually become fruits for most plants. I can't say that I've necessarily, and we do have your image up now, and I can't say that I've ever actually seen a potato flower go to a fruit like that, but obviously any tubered plant is also going to produce a seed. So many plants propagate themselves in a variety of ways, and I'm wondering if the reason I've never seen that is usually about the time ours flower is also when that those tops start dying back. And maybe, you know, yours has just gone long enough, but almost every flower on an angiosperm is eventually going to turn into a fruiting body of some nature or another to produce the fruit for the seed. So I'm assuming that's what's happening.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to dry that out and see what kind of seeds I get. I suppose plant those, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's where we would probably get potato seed if people... The thing is it's going to take you probably a much longer time to get a potato plant out of a seed.
Yeah.
Right, well, maybe it'll be a winter project.
There you go.
There you go.
Sounds like fun.
So thanks, Paul.
Thanks. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. I appreciate the call. Louie in Manitowish Waters, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate your call.
You bet. And I've got a problem. I've been trying to grow zucchinis in my garden, and they blossom and bloom, but never produce any fruit. I can remember about 4 or 5 years ago, the first time I tried it, I had fruit, and since then, only flowers. What's my problem?
What's happening to the flowers? Are you watching to see? Are they just drying up? Do they show like a rot?
Yes, there's a lot of blossoms. They open up during the day, nice and full, and close up in the evening, and everything seems normal except for bearing fruit.
Hmm.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm not sure zucchini might get a rot similar to blossom end rot on a tomato. It's hard to tell. I mean, if the flower just eventually shrivels up and dries up in a natural way, then that's probably not it. But if you see those flowers literally look like they're getting all soft and mushy like they're rotting, then I would say that there's a disease issue there.
Yeah, would it be an excess nitrogen issue? Could that be?
You know, sometimes if you overdo on the nitrogen, you know, then they might, you know, blast and not, it'll go all to vegetative and not to the flower and fruit.
But
although
the flowers
it seems
are there.
Adi's not getting any fruit whatsoever.
That's really strange.
Okay, I do use a little 10-10-10 early in the growing process.
Yep, that shouldn't do
that
it.
Shouldn't
I was going to say
problem.
If you were dumping a lot of Miracle-Grow on it, which is very heavy in nitrogen, but no, 10-10-10 shouldn't affect
okay.
anything. I think maybe I would check with a fruit and vegetable specialist through the extension. It's not something I've got a lot of experience with.
Yeah.
I've not seen that. Usually the last vegetable we have problems with are zucchini.
Yeah.
That's other than how to get rid of the fruit.
Right. Any dummy can grow zucchini, but I can't.
Yeah.
Well,
there's something it could be, I don't know if it could even be a pollinating issue if you don't have pollinators in there that are pollinating.
Well, that's the other thing. Yeah.
That could be an issue as well. I mean, obviously, they need pollination in order to go to fruit. But it does seem very odd that you're not getting a single fruit at all. That doesn't sound right.
No, it doesn't. You might want to send some blossoms. I mean, if it looks like it's rotting, Brian Huddleston maybe could take a look at it, the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. But it doesn't sound like it sounds healthy.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah, I got me.
And maybe one of our callers will have had
maybe somebody else will experience
and can help you with that.
Yeah, so stay listening, Louis. Appreciate your call. I'll have to ask Brian if he's heard that. Ruth in Milton, hi, thanks for calling.
Oh, yes. I have an old-fashioned white hydrangea that's been here at the east side of this house. I've been here since 1967, and I'm sure it was here long before. I have a lot of hard work because it sends up aggressively sends up these sprouts at the, and I have to control it against the siding at the house foundation. I hand prune them out. What would happen if I used Roundup on those? Would it affect the main shrub?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You would be toxifying the entire shrub. And anybody that's heard me before on the radio, I'm pretty anti using pesticides for absolutely every issue out there. And they also know that I'm using Roundup as the so-called Kleenex of pesticides. Roundup is very specific to certain things, but everybody goes and uses Roundup on every issue that they have, and that's not even what Roundup would have been formulated for.
Mm.
But any herbicide that you put on that plant, all those suckers are all going into the root system of that plant.
Mm.
So if you're poisoning some, then it's certainly going to poison others. And I'm assuming you have hydrangea arborescens. That would be the shrub form that dies back in the fall and then comes up with new growth in the spring.
Well, I actually leave them up in the winter for winter.
Correct, but they're
kind of
dead, right?
About them.
Yeah, they're dead.
Yeah,
though.
They die, but they die back, and usually you
right.
go yes, and you get all new growth in the spring. That's a hydrangea arborescens. Your best option there is to divide them, get them back down, you know, to a more manageable size.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Thanks, Ruth. Thank you for calling, and good luck with your dividing. Our guest today, Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up next week on Garden Talk, Erin LaFave will be with us. She's the horticulture educator for UW Extension in Eau Claire County. Right now, though, visiting with Ed Lyon of the Allen Centennial Gardens in Madison, I think we have one open line. So if you have a question for Ed, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. I've already had some interesting photos as well posted to my Facebook page. Certainly you can do that too. Post a photo, maybe just a pretty photo of your garden, or maybe you've got something for us to take a closer look at, see if we can figure out what it is. That's at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Rosemary in Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. 6 years ago, I bought a beautiful Easter lily, and I planted it, and it came up 4 years in a row with this beautiful white Easter lily blooms. Last year, it came up with the blooms again, but they were deep cranberry. Now, this year, it came up again, and I had 9 blooms on it, not the 2, and they were all 9, this gorgeous, gorgeous deep cranberry. What's up with this?
Yeah. You've got me. And first off, are you sure it's an Easter lily? Because they shouldn't be hardy in the ground.
Yep, I bought it. I bought it at Easter time, and you know, I have this beautiful Easter lily, and I even got the wonderful smell from them.
And most lilies will have smell. I have a feeling that even though you bought it at Easter, it's not a true Easter lily because that should not be surviving over winter in the ground. And that would probably also explain maybe why it's changed color. Because if it's a
lily, but
yeah, if it's an Asiatic or something similar, a hardy lily, there are many times plants might revert back to an original color of a parent plant genetically. But I can't imagine it's a true Easter lily because that wouldn't be hardy on the ground. And if it is like an Asiatic lily, then I suspect that's what's happened is something has happened in those bulbs to change the color.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
You know, 4 years in a row, beautiful white, and then all of a sudden cranberry.
Yeah, well, sometimes...
And I bought it at Easter time, and it said Easter lily.
Well, now, you can get an awful lot of things mislabeled, so...
I'm sure.
But so actually, it's probably a good thing, because had it been a true Easter lily, it wouldn't be coming back every year for you.
Yep.
Really?
Nope.
Really. And I have a friend who also plants her Easter lilies after, you know, after they've died back, and they grow every year for her, too. So, but hers always come up white. Mine came up this beautiful cranberry color.
Well, I have to say, if you're putting Easter lilies in the ground and they're coming back for you and your friend every year, you guys are master gardeners.
Yeah. We are, and we didn't even take the class.
Either that or the source you're buying from, they may be just using an Asiatic lily versus the Easter lily.
Yep.
Rosemary, you do me a favor now. When they bloom this year, would you take a photo and send it to my Facebook page?
They have already bloomed and have died off.
Oh.
I have pictures. So I will send them to you.
Oh, I would. Please do. Post one on my Facebook page, and we would all love to see what that cranberry colored lily.
Yeah, and we could probably help you out too if we saw the flower. Tell you whether it's maybe more an Asiatic than a true Easter lily.
Okay, I can do that. I can't do it right now, but I will do it for you, Larry. And then can you then
make sure Ed sees it? Yep.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your calling to do that. Just my Facebook page for the radio program is just The Larry Mealer Show. And you can go there, and anybody can go there. Don't have to be on Facebook member yourself to be able to go and view things that are on that site. Michelle in Blue Mounds, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I have a mystery on my hands. I planted a live roof, and so it came in on the mats in 20 by 20 squares. So it came in on its own medium, and 3 years later now, the sedum grew up, it turned pink, it flowered, and then a certain section of the garden, all of the stalks dried to almost brittle, and the flower heads have gone to kind of a deep rust. And there is new growth underneath, but what I noticed in the dirt are these little teeny white specks, and they don't move, but I don't know if I'm looking for mold or if I'm looking for bugs. And my additional question is, it's an underlying drip system. How often should you water? What's your optimal watering procedure? This part of the live garden is actually over earth. It's the roof goes from roof down to the ground. And so this part of the roof isn't over the actual building.
So you planted them, essentially. They're on soil.
Yeah, so the part of the garden that's struggling is it's actually over soil, but it came in on its own medium.
Okay. The first thought is that it sounds like they're getting too much moisture. Is that a possibility?
Totally a possibility.
Yeah.
Right now, the drip system set up to go for about an hour a day.
Well, usually when succulents start doing that, the first thing is too much moisture and I can't tell you whether that, you said an hour a day?
That's a lot of water.
It's a passive drip, so it's not like a sprinkler.
Correct, but that still seems like an awful lot of water for succulents. You know, usually succulents dry out for good long times before they see water again. My first thought is too much water. If it's not too much water, then that section might have some type of fungal disease issue. But I would think water, the disease would probably take them much faster. What you're describing looks more slow and to me like they're just starting to languish and not do real well, especially if there's new growth because they're getting too much water.
Okay, and so how would I check would I do a soil sample or just bring a section of the plants in? And these are sedums. So when you say succulents, are succulents and sedums the same?
It's succulents, just a broad overall term for sedums and many other categories of plants. If you are suspicious of a disease organism, then probably a sample of the plant and some of the soil. Otherwise, if it's water, I'd get the water off it and just see if that doesn't improve
that's
it.
That's what I do.
Yeah. Cut way back on the water. An hour a day is excessive.
Hour a week is more like it.
Yeah, that's a lot for even perennial plants.
Wow, okay. All right, and then where would I take a sample?
Oh, the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. You could do it through your county extension office or just go online to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic and you'll get the information you need there as to they like to have a sort of a healthy and diseased part of the plant if you can find, you know.
Some of both.
Okay, great.
But the University of Wisconsin Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic.
Perfect.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate that call. We have Pat in Appleton. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I have Canadian thistles that I can't get rid of. I was going to try spraying them with Roundup.
Don't do that.
Canada thistles.
Everybody wants to use Roundup for everything. The only real herbicide that I have found that works on Canada thistle at all is called Stinger. And you may have heard me talk.
How do you spell that?
Just like a stinger and a bee. Stinger.
Stinger. Okay.
Yep. And you may have heard me mention to the previous caller, it's frustrating that everybody uses Roundup for absolutely everything. All of you folks need to be looking at the labels on the pesticides that you're using and see what they are specific to. Even Roundup, even though it's a fairly broad spectrum pesticide, isn't to be used for absolutely everything out there. And research is showing Roundup is going to be causing some of the same health issues and toxicities in the environment that every other pesticide that, you know, that we've determined are harmful to us. So, and we're out there indiscriminately spraying this on everything for every problem. So is this an infestation in a large area or a small area?
Pretty much. Well, it's all in different spots around the backyard, and I've got grandchildren, so the stinger, can you use it?
Well, any pesticide, it would keep children and pets away from it. Every pesticide is toxic. You have to keep that in mind. And if you apply it, the method that I would, don't go out there and just spray it. You're going to be not only killing off other plants that are around the thistle, but you're going to be killing off different organisms, insects, beneficial organisms in the environment. What I would do is you mix it to the specifications. Always read what the proper concentration is. Read about what are the proper temperatures to apply it. These are things that people ignore, and then they wonder why it doesn't work. And then you would need to paint it on. Use a brush or something of that nature. Another method that I have used is I'll put a vinyl glove on my hand and then a soft glove over that. Make sure it's a vinyl glove strong enough that chemical is not going to touch your skin. But then I'll dip the hand with this double glove into the chemical and then wipe the plant with that. That sometimes is easier than painting it. But just don't go out there and be spraying away. All that particulate matter is going into the air. It's going into the soil. And you're killing off a lot more than just the thistle.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. We had an email from Joe in Portage County. He says, I've grown native prickly pear cactus for years. They're perennials and do well. I propagated several thornless prickly pear pads I found in the produce section of the grocery store. They are growing well, but have never overwintered outside. Are these cactus winter hardy in zone 4?
Not likely.
No.
It's interesting. Prickly pear is the opuntia cactus. And I did not realize that when I first moved out here from upstate New York and I found opuntia growing along the Wisconsin River, I thought it was somebody's idea of a joke. And I have since learned that there are actually opuntia native to every state in the Union. But certainly ones that are coming out of the Southwest aren't going to overwinter here. However, there are more opuntia that are hardy here than we realized. We thought it was just our native one. In fact, David and Nancy Nedvick from the Flower Factory, one of my very favorite places to shop, right here near Madison. David has been experimenting with a large number of cacti. We've been putting them in our rock garden at Allen Centennial Gardens, and there's probably, I bet, 12 to 20 different cacti.
Yeah.
And boy, when they're bloom, they're just gorgeous. So we now have not only the yellow flowers, we have pinks and whites. And so if you're really interested in hardy cacti in Wisconsin, I would make a visit to the Flower Factory and talk to David. He's been probably the one person in the state that I know that has real good experience with that, plus actual cacti we know are overwintering.
We had an email from Mark in Green Bay. What methods might be available to propagate lilac cuttings from an existing plant? Is air layering a possibility?
I'm not sure, to tell you the truth. I mean, lilacs you would normally do softwood cuttings on. I would actually have to look that up to see if you could do air layering. I would certainly think that would be a relatively easy thing to look up and find, whether you're Googling it or, you know, using a propagation book.
Here's another one. I don't know about this one either. A Facebook question from Melinda. Is it hard to cross calla lilies? Why do the colors seem fairly limited for these plants?
That I can't tell you. I'm not an experienced with calla lilies, but there's quite a wide range of colors that I know of, anything from deep, rich purple burgundies to yellows. I mean, there's no blues, but there's no blues in many plants. I think maybe your source that you're looking for calla lilies, extend your search, because there actually are quite a few different colors out there in calla lilies.
Mary in Eau Claire, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. Yesterday, I had this dwarf pomegranate. I put it outside in the summer and bring it in the winter, because obviously a pomegranate's not going to overwinter in Wisconsin. And yesterday I was repotting it, and I saw all these little tiny gray things that look like barnacles on it. So I started knocking them off. I mean, there were hundreds and hundreds of them.
That sounds like scale.
Well, I looked at them actually under a microscope.
Mm-hmm.
The insides looked different, and they were full. Each one of them was full of hundreds of eggs. I mean, I had to go to a 50-100 power microscope to see them.
Well,
yeah, I mean, if they're barnacle-looking, that sounds like scale to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think your best option is probably to collect some of them and send to the entomology department. If you have an entomologist somewhere near you, I'd take it to an entomologist, certainly if it has eggs.
Okay, well, yeah, I put half a dozen of them in a Ziploc bag this morning, and there's little orange dust all over the place.
I mean, an entomologist is probably your best bet for true, accurate identification of what you have there.
Actually, if you could get some to the insect diagnostic lab at the UW-Madison, what Phil Pelletieri used to head, and now we have a new director there, but he knows his stuff too, and the Insect Diagnostic Lab, UW-Madison, if you send them the actual animals, whatever they are, or if you can get some photos, some pretty close-up photos, they might be able to just, if you could email it, they might be able to just answer it right off an email.
Yeah, and I advise people when you're taking photos, first off, obviously try to get really good resolution, but take several. Don't just take one. Maybe take an image of how they appear on your pomegranate, and then other images of them separated off that. All of us who are horticulturists, we get pictures sent to us all the time from people. And it's so hard sometimes because the resolution is poor or the angle is bad. So, you know, make sure you take a few pictures and really concentrate on getting good resolution when you do that.
Okay. I took, you know, about a dozen pictures yesterday.
All right. Yep. Well,
I'd never seen anything like it before.
Yeah, try the pictures, and if they can't identify it, then they'll probably ask you to send it in to them, and then they'll tell you how to do that.
So University of Wisconsin Insect Diagnostic Lab.
Wisconsin Insect Diagnostic Lab. Okay,
yeah, University of Wisconsin. Yep. All right. Give it a shot. See what happens. Steve in Ives Grove, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate the call. What have you got for us today?
Well, I've got some buckthorn growing up in spruce trees. And I know that the best way to get rid of buckthorn is to cut it at ground and paint it with the Roundup herbicide.
No, not Roundup. Again, Roundup. I use Tordon.
Tordon. Let me write that down.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple of different chemicals that you can use. But again, here we're using Roundup for every application out there.
Tordon, though, will do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You're just reusing the wrong herbicide, and this is one of the big problems and why the pesticides are continuing to contaminate our planet is we're using the wrong things, the wrong products, and not getting results. And
Tordon is T-O-R-D-O-N.
Yes. Yep.
T-O-R-D-O-N. Thank you for calling, Steve. Good luck with it. And we'll take some more calls. But just to remind you, our guest today, Ed Lyon, directs the Allen Centennial Gardens on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus and has been doing that since 2008, isn't it?
That is correct.
Yeah, 2008.
Hard to believe.
Well, I tell you what, it's great to have him along and great to have you listening. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this edition of Garden Talk. We visit with Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. Questions for him as we talk gardening, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post a photo and or question on my Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. And we are going next to Mike in Summit Lake. Mike, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hey, good Friday to you. I have a question on some apple gardening.
Okay.
I have six apple trees that I nurtured for about 4 years now to get them the producing size. And this last winter, the voles or meadow mice girdled them completely for about 2 feet. They still
2 feet,
put out
2 feet
they
total
put out leaves. Pardon?
2 feet from ground up?
From the ground up, yeah.
Oh, my.
They're goners.
So, yeah, they're not going to make it.
Okay, but now this year they put out leaves and some fruit. And I'm wondering now, is it possible to graft new stock onto that root stock, because that's been developed now. You know, they should have a good root system.
Then what you're saying is you must have some of the bark intact from the ground up then.
No, there is no bark. The wood is dry and cracked, and yet they still put out leaves and fruit.
Yeah, I'd be very cautious of using that rootstock because I would think that it's probably pretty heavily damaged at this point. You know, either those trees themselves are going to recover or I would replace them. And again, you don't even, if you want to graft onto that rootstock, it's, you know, once they die, you can try it. But boy, I'd be very leery if you've got that much damage on them.
Yep.
And you know, those are the kinds of things I tell people, if this is something you really want to play with to see if it works, go for it. But if you're really looking to have good, healthy trees again, then I probably would replace them.
There you go.
All right.
Thanks, Mike, for calling. Vicki in Duluth, Minnesota. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi there. So I'm a charter member of the Fearmonger Society, and going back to the idea of gathering seed from potato plants, I have read that that's not a good idea, because being members of the nightshade family, if they get crossed with something, another potato, you don't know how much poison is going to go into the potato.
I had not heard that myself. So you're saying crossing two different potatoes together and then taking the seed will make the potato toxic?
It could, you see. You don't know what you're going to get. And that's why we always buy seed potatoes, because they've been, you know, propagated from a line where they know that they're safe.
Well, that's good to know, because the gentleman, hopefully the gentleman who thinks he might, you know, try that, that's good for him to know that.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not something that I had heard of, certainly if that's the case, then he wouldn't want to be growing out potatoes. I think it might be a little difficult to grow potato plants from seed anyway. But
yeah. Thanks, Vicki. Appreciate that call and that information. Alan Mill in Menominee has something for us, too. Hi, Al. Thank you for calling.
Sure. We planted about 11 years ago a row of lilacs, probably 100 feet, and they've grown, and they're about 6 foot tall, and they've blossomed after a couple of years. And these were just salvage plants from our old yard and other places. And about 3-4 years ago, we put in added on to that row about 10 feet of plants, and they'd gotten up to about 3 feet tall. And last year in the heat and the drought, all of a sudden we realized they were turning brown, and we soaked them up, and we got some recovery last fall. And then this year, they sort of turned green, and then they started dying back, and now it's just working itself up the line. It's about 10 feet into the mature plants that have, they just slowly turn brown. You know, they don't start from a certain spot on the plant. There's no mildew or mold or anything, it seems like. They just start turning brown, and then they go from there. I think all the young plants now are totally finished, or at least there's nothing that shows any sign of life.
Yeah,
and I would say if it was only the young plants, then your issue there was just the fact that they were stressed out from the original
right.
situation of not getting watered. And
but,
of course,
but we've had lots of water this year.
Actually, a lot of the deaths that was blamed on this hard winter this year actually goes back to the drought of 2012.
Sure.
Root systems were so damaged at that time, and plants have been trying to recover. A lot of deciduous trees this spring started to leaf out, and we were cutting deciduous trees and shrubs out of the garden well into June. Because they'd start to leaf out and then just give up the ghost. And I was told that the reason for this is it wasn't just the cold temperatures of the winter. These plants have been trying to recover their root systems since that really bad drought we had. Trees and shrubs very often take a number of years for these various things to take their toll on them.
Oh.
Very often it's not the last thing that you see that killed them, but a series of things. However, that being said, it would worry me that this browning is going into an established stand. That's making me sound more like there's a disease issue there.
Mm-hmm.
And then your best option is to get a piece of the diseased plant and a piece of healthy plant and get it right into a diagnostic lab. I know everybody wants to, you know, call somebody on the radio and say, what do I do? The best advice we can give you is get it in there and get it accurately diagnosed so you can do something about it right away.
Yeah. And again, the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison is a good place to go for that. And best to not mail it at the end of the week. Mail it so that it might sit in the office over the weekend. Better to mail
it. Send it in on Monday.
On a Monday. Yep.
But I would get it in right away so you can find out
yep.
if there's a disease issue so you can take care of it right away.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And Julian in Burlington. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you guys doing today?
Good, appreciate the call.
I have a question. I'm kind of new at the whole gardening aspect. We just bought a house, and we have quite a few raspberry bushes, and I've been cleaning them out every couple days, just maintaining them. But we have an infestation of little Japanese beetles, and my kids love to go and pick and eat the raspberries, so I don't want to spray them with anything. I'm just trying to find the best method to...
It wouldn't do you any good if you did spray them. That won't deter the Japanese beetles, and there is no spray out there that will kill the Japanese beetles. And they love raspberries. They love raspberry plants. And I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but your only real recourse is you're picking off those Japanese beetles and dropping them in soapy water. Putting any kind of pesticide on them is going to do nothing but, you know.
Or a floating row cover over the top, and even that.
Yeah, to try and keep them from getting on in the first place.
Okay, well.
That can work.
And do you know what a floating row cover is?
No, not
if you're new to gardening. That's basically a gauzy type of netting that they'll sell.
Really cheaply.
Yeah, and it's to keep the birds and insects off literally eating your fruits. And you're basically just laying it gently over those plants.
And any good garden center will have it, and it really is inexpensive.
All right, well, I think... Thank you so much for all this information.
Yep. Appreciate your call. Thank you for calling. We have just a mention on our Facebook page. Donna has sent us some photos of her lilies. She's got some pretty ones.
And she sure does.
Oh, man. They're gorgeous. Thank you for sending those. And Irene in Madison has a question for us. So, Irene, thanks for calling. Hi.
Oh, yes, thank you. And I always enjoy your garden show, Larry.
Thank you.
About the Easter lily, I was able to overwinter Easter lilies, but not for long. Maybe one or two winters. Maybe the winters were not severe. So, but it was kind of fun to try. And it didn't work for long, so.
Yeah, my mom was always in zone denial, and she'd always put the Easter lilies in the ground. And I'd tell her, oh, you know, that's never going to survive. Well, one year it did, so she was just so pleased that she could tell me I was wrong.
Well, it's probably not that you're wrong, but maybe the winter was mild or something.
Yeah.
But it's fun to try. About the zucchini. Mm-hmm. Perhaps it's a lack of calcium. That was my issue. Of course, I don't have an in-ground garden, but I've been trying to grow zucchinis in large pots. And last year I had beautiful plants, loads of flowers, loads of happy bees, and no fruit whatsoever. So then I read someplace on the internet there might be calcium, and I went to the Bruce Garden Center here in Madison, and plant expert there pointed me to a fertilizer to use, and that had calcium in it, bone meal and other things called Plantone or Tomato Tone. And, well, apparently it worked because I have beautiful zucchinis this year. So I don't know. Maybe that was.
Yep. And you may be right. Maybe he does have a micronutrient deficiency. And in that case, a soil sample would probably be a good idea because that would help him correct it and know which micronutrient he might be deficient in. Yeah. So thanks for that call. That's an idea I hadn't thought about.
Yep.
Sympathize with him because it's so frustrating when the plants look beautiful and the flowers look beautiful and then there's no fruit.
You imagine telling people you're growing zucchini and can't get fruit? They're going to think you can't garden at all, right?
That's right. Oh, thanks, Irene. Thank you so much. We have caller Dan from Wisconsin Dells, the first-time potato grower, wonders how he'll know when the potatoes are ready to harvest.
Well, we let the tops of the potatoes die down. And they'll start that maybe in about 2 weeks or so, yeah. I think. It always depends on the heat and moisture and things of that nature. Ours look really good right now. They're very thick and full. But the tops on them will start to dry down at some point. And they'll stay in the ground for a fair amount of time. It's not like you have to get them out at any immediate time. In fact, we used to even start digging some for what my dad would always call new potatoes. And eat them when they were smaller. But that's generally
Like doing that, actually. Yeah. They taste great.
That's generally what we do, is wait till the tops die back down.
And then an earlier caller had wondered, his herbicide question was, if he has the proper herbicide to put on the buckthorn to kill it, and does that, but it's in amongst the spruce trees, will somehow, even if he doesn't touch the spruce trees with the material, would it, through the root system of the buckthorn, travel to the root system of the other?
No, it won't. They don't do root grafting together, those two species. Some trees like maples, oaks, will literally root graft from tree to tree. That's why some of the oak wilt and diseases of that are an issue, but certainly not spruce and buckthorn. So what will happen is that buckthorn will take that chemical down through the cambium tissue into the root system. It will stay there. It will not then move on to the spruce.
Boy, so many good things to talk about here on the Ideas Network. Our guest today, Ed Lyon. Ed directs the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus. He is he's staffed by one full-time person himself, plus a whole lot of volunteers that help him out. Ed Lyon for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, and you're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Net. It's one of the really fun things we do every week here on the Ideas Net, and always have great guests, and certainly today is no exception. Ed Lyon, director of the Allen Centennial Gardens, our guest today to be with us for Garden Talk. And Ed, as always, a real pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time.
Well, it's always fun to do.
We have callers, and we've got lots of Facebook questions, and let's take a caller first here. Jennifer in Pleasant Prairie, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling about, we have some dwarf Korean lilac shrubs. They're about 4 years old, and for the first time this summer, they're having quite a bit of dead wood in the center, primarily the center of the shrubs. And what I'm wondering is if it's too late in the summer for me to trim those out, maybe do that, I think it's called residual pruning, where you trim them right back to the ground. I'm less concerned about next year's blooms on the areas I trim, just more concerned with the health of the plant. And then I'm also wondering if it is okay to do that, if you could kind of go over the process. And then I'm also wondering if the same thing can be done for other shrubs that bloom in the spring, like we have some dark night white gilia and some nine bark, I can't remember which one, but they all are having the same sort of dead wood look all of a sudden.
Well, you can cut the dead wood out at any time, and obviously you're not worried about bloom because it is dead wood. I would not probably do an it sounds like there's some issue if you're getting some dead wood in all of these various shrubs. So I don't think I would go and just cut these shrubs right off at the ground at this point. I would cut out anything that looks bad and looks dead. Now, lilacs over time will have old wood that needs to be cut out anyway. And then you might cut back a little bit on any, other branches that don't look particularly good. But you've got the rest of the summer to go through that these plants need to photosynthesize. So if they're having some kind of issue, and I'm suspicious, it might be the issue I was talking about before. Frosts were so deep this year and damaged the root systems of a lot of deciduous plant materials. I'd be a little bit leery then cutting them back and then not having the photosynthesis for these roots to continue to heal themselves and and grow out. So at this point, I think I would just cut out anything that looks dead and then watch. Now, if you continue to get branching that's dying, you mm-hmm. might have a disease issue there. And in that case, as we've been saying to the other listeners that have had similar issues, get some of that material into the diagnostic lab and find out what's happening. But it could be just as simple as extreme damage to root systems this year because of those deep frosts that we had.
Okay. And then when I trim those shrubs, do I risk opening up that plant and having some kind of pest get on the plant, or is that not a great risk?
Those aren't, the shrubs you've mentioned aren't particularly prone to pests. And again, you're just cutting out dead tissue. So those where you, the pests are a problem is when you've cut open living tissue okay. and then they're carrying a disease or a virus or something and they land on that and it ends up, you know, entering the plant. But cutting out dead wood, you shouldn't have any issue at all.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you so
and
much.
And take it all the way back to wherever it looks like it's dead to, which it sounds like with most of yours is right down to the ground.
Yeah. Thank you, Jen, for calling. Facebook question from Patricia. We're cleaning grass out of our rock garden and having trouble getting rid of it.
Well, that depends on what kind of grass you have. Certainly, if you have rhizomatous grass in there like quack grass and crab grass, and I'm not sure what kind of rock garden you have, if it's just a garden with rocks and perennials planted in it or an alpine rock garden. But if you've got grass that is taking over, is becoming invasive, you've got to be able to get out all of those rhizomes as well. Because if all you're doing is pulling it and breaking it off, it's just going to keep coming back on you. I guess it depends on how planted your rock garden is. In many cases, we rejuvenate gardens. So we're doing it all the time at Allen Gardens. If a garden gets too overly infested with weeds, we'll actually pull out what we can of the good plants and we'll start all over again. We'll get in there, get rid of whatever the noxious weed is, and then replant. Sometimes that's the only method. I think as gardeners, we think that certain gardens we put in will be last indefinitely, and that's not always the case. Sometimes certain infestations require us to get right in there and get rid of the infestation and replant. One thing I will add, if we have perennials or plants that we know those grasses or whatever's being noxious still growing up through them, I will throw away those perennials before putting them back in and risking adding that back in. It's far better to go out and buy new with clean root systems.
Doug in Richland Center, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a problem I'm hoping you can help me with. Bamboo. I had a large section of it, probably 15 feet across, and it was very dense. And we went in and took out as many of the root bundles that we could, but every year it continues to come up.
What kind of now, bamboo are you talking about?
Well, it wasn't like the old bamboo that you get fishing poles from it, but I was told it was bamboo and it looked very similar to.
Now, did
to
they
the
call it Mexican bamboo by any
that
chance?
That I don't know. It has a large, kind of a heart-shaped leaf. And a couple of years ago, I found something that would kill it commercially, but I don't have any anymore. And the regular tough poison ivy and kudzu killer will not do it. It has spreading roots, and it comes up every year. I even tried a homemade mixture using vinegar, salt, and dish soap.
Yeah, those
and they laugh at
work.
It.
Yeah, those
home remedies don't work. I would suspect what you have is what is commonly called Mexican bamboo. It's a polygonum, and it's really, really noxious. It's on the invasive plant list here in Wisconsin. It is extremely difficult to eradicate. It'll grow under highways and come up on the other side. It invades stream beds. What I would do first is get an accurate identification of what you've got. For me to tell you on the radio to go out and buy such a thing without accurately identifying the plant. There's a lot of plants out there that are mistakenly called bamboo. So I'd get the plant identified and then probably work with extension for the proper course of eradication. And in this case, the DNR might even be able to help you. Because if it's the plant that I think it is, it's one that they're already dealing with.
And you can send this is a case where if you get a picture of the plant and the leaves and, you know, a few photos, they're probably going to be able to identify photos.
Yeah. And again, it could make a difference where you are. If you're near a waterway or a natural area, it can cause some issues. But get it accurately identified and then work with, I would say work with extension first and they can help you.
Thanks, Doug. Jocelyn in Sheboygan. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, good afternoon. Last year, I have a comment and a question. Last year, I had a couple of plants. They ended up, you know, it seemed that they were growing 2 feet a day. And they have several leaves, different type leaves. And I know you probably, you know, I'm pretty sure it's an invasive plant. I had just two in this year. I can't really garden because I have health problems, but now I have a forest. And I have a real tiny, the birds love it because they can perch on everything, you know. I have a very tiny yard. And then there's another kind of tree that seems to grow everywhere. They call it a weed, but I have no idea what the name of it is. And that's, it just, it doesn't grow as fast, but every year it looks better and better, you know. And I've had a couple of others starting in my little yard of that also. But I also wanted to say to you, thank you for saying, you know, to everybody wants to use all these chemicals. I am so sick of that because that runs off. You have millions of people using these poisons. For one thing, why is it even legal to put all this poison on our food and the plants? And now I'm even afraid to buy a hanging plant because on Science Friday they said that they're full of these neonics that are probably killing the bees. And they said with this poison, these neonics, one little corn kernel can kill a songbird. I mean, this is just insanity. I don't know if you can...
Mm-hmm. Well, so first, as far as your trees, again, just as I said to the last caller, take some pictures. I can't help you without any accurate ID. And even if you had a really good description of it, we might mistake it for something else, and we certainly don't want to do that. So try to get some good images. One of our best resources in the state are our cooperative extension professionals. Get those pictures to somebody, ask them if they are an invasive plant and what you can do about them. And yes, pesticides are an issue. They'll continue to be. I work with college student interns on a daily basis, and I think about what they're going to be cleaning up behind us. It's not a problem that's going to go away anytime soon. All I can do from my end is emphasize to people that if you're going to use these chemicals, one of the largest problems is total ignoring the labels, not using them for what they're specified for, not using them at the right concentrations, right temperatures, just mixing the stuff on and indiscriminately spraying is a crime in my estimation. But it's not a problem that's going to be solved immediately, and future generations are absolutely going to be dealing with it.
Jocelyn, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to get this comment in from Ann, an email, actually, in the Garden District in Milwaukee. I just planted a PG hydrangea yesterday. Since this time of year brings such great sales on plants and trees, right about that, after getting it all situated and stacked, I realized I made the mistake of not cutting a crisscross on the bottom of the soil ball to prevent any girdling of the roots. I'm wondering how important this is and if I should dig it back up or not. I have already treated with a root stabilizer as well.
Well, first off, just doing a crisscross on the bottom of any kind of plant that's been root congested isn't going to do any good. What the idea is you are supposed to be separating out those roots and getting them out of that root ball. So that means actually soaking that plant in water, getting all of the growing mix out of there, and then getting those roots so that you can separate out when you go to plant a tree like that, that they're all laying out flat and out in the direction that they're supposed to grow. The bad news is current research is now showing us that these plants, and this is where going to containerization and selling plants is a problem, is that once many of these trees start circling, they are almost become genetically predisposed to it. And there's been a lot of research done. Green Bay Botanic Garden actually did some of this, where they took trees that had circling issues, did cut them as they were told to, put them in the ground, and they continued to circle anyway. So my best advice to people, and you know, maybe it's a great sale and a great price on a plant, but if you're in the nursery and you pull it up and out of the pot and you look at those roots and they're circled, I wouldn't buy it. You need to be looking for plants that haven't been sitting in those pots for extended time periods, because down the line it's just going to create an issue for you. And even if you do what is properly advised and soak them, get the growing media out and pull those roots out, think about the enormous amount of stress that they're under.
Yeah.
So your best bet is to pay the price for a quality product from an independent garden center that they can tell you, you know, these how long they've had the plants. The plants that have been kept for year after year, the longer they keep them in those containers, the more encircled they'll be. In your case, yes, I would definitely try get it back up and out of the ground. But you're going to put this plant under a lot of stress by getting those roots out where they belong to be. Simply crisscrossing a root ball is not going to be enough.
We have Ellen in Waupun next. Ellen, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. And this has just been an hour and a half of vast amounts of information. Thank you so much. I have issues with earwigs. What do you recommend?
And they're in your garden plants, I'm assuming.
Garden, yes, okay. Right. Lettuce and kale and whatnot.
Yeah. I have a sluggo. Certainly works. I use sluggo on my hostas for both slugs, but it also works for earwigs. Now, This is not something that Milorganite will advertise, because you can use Milorganite as repellents, but they won't label it as such, because then they have to label themselves as a pesticide. But I use Milorganite, and that also seems to repel the slugs and the earwigs too. Now, that's anecdotal. I don't know any research that tells you that. But it seems to me that works as well. But sluggo, it's more expensive, but it is very effective.
Good. As far as the Milorganite goes, do you have to work that into the soil?
No. I just spread it on top of the ground underneath the plants. I find it is a rabbit deterrent, deer deterrent, and some of the pests like slugs and earwigs. But like I said, again, I'm giving you anecdotal information, not something that's been researched.
Well, I have some in the shed. I shall go try it.
All right. Give it a shot. Thanks, Ellen. And Steve in Waupaca, thank you for calling. Hi.
Well, you're welcome. I have a problem with a pest that's a little different, and I've had this a little bit before, and I've had some success, but all of a sudden I have a woodchuck that burrowed under my shed, and then from there, I think into the, I think under my shed, and then from there into the middle of my garden. And of course, he's helping himself. He's got to burrow under because we do have it fenced, and he's been trying to get under the fence, and we've been using mothballs, which seems to have deterred it. And I think now he said, "Hey, I'm tired of these mothballs. I'm going to go all the way in." So. Any suggestions?
Oh, and they'll eliminate a row of beans in an evening.
Oh, yeah.
Well, lead poisoning's...
My pole beans are tall enough that he can't get up to the top, but I do have some Jacob's cattle beans that I grow every year, and he's kind of starting to eliminate them. So
yeah, they're quite a nuisance, and if you're not looking to kill it...
I'm not sure how effective it is to
trap woodchucks. I've never have really heard.
I've trapped 11. Trapped 11.
Oh, you've trapped them.
11 off my yard.
Yep. That's probably going to be your best bet is to trap them and remove them from the property.
Yeah.
Larry says, I
did talk to the DNR yesterday, and they said that's what they suggested, but they said trap them and then euthanize them. So I'm thinking if I'm going to euthanize them, I might as well just use my 22 to start with because I
do live
in the country and I could do that. But I was hoping that maybe you had just mentioned the organite. Do you think that would be kind of a deterrent? Or
The trouble with all of the deterrents, the thing with the woodchuck is he's made a home there. So the problem with most of these deterrents that deer, rabbit, and woodchucks, they eventually get used to it. So for the woman who had the earwig problem, that's a very short period seasonal thing. You've got a woodchuck who's made his home there. He's going to eventually get used to almost anything that you're doing. So they're short-term fixes. The fact that he's got his home there is a much longer-term issue.
And the problem with, if you trap them, you have to have a place where you can release them. And so you have to have permission anywhere to release. And frankly, the issue with that is some of the wildlife researchers say that an animal that gets put in a new location, dropped into a new location like that, often dies. And dies a more miserable death than if they were... euthanized after they were trapped. So,
and you may be creating an issue for somebody else wherever you drop it off. So,
yeah, that
I had thought about dropping it off at Hartman Creek State Park here, but the DNR guy says you can't drop it on any state property.
No,
holes can be actually quite dangerous, you know, in various ways. The holes that they create, so you want to be careful of that.
Well, yeah, I just. I'm out on a job, and I just stepped into a woodchuck hole, so I know exactly what
you're saying. Yeah, absolutely. So there you have it. I have had a lot of good experience with Have a Heart traps, and I've trapped many of them. In fact, I trapped 9 one summer off a small lawn lot on the lake. So I know it can be done, and finally I solved the problem. I trapped and trapped and trapped, and finally there were none left.
What do you use for bait?
Carrots, you know, just other, you know, vegetables, I never had any trouble, frankly. Yep,
that's good to know.
A caller in Dubuque wonders where he can find liquid calcium for his plants. I have liquid calcium.
Yeah, I can't tell you offhand. I've never had to buy liquid calcium.
I haven't either. I wonder if they have liquid calcium.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like anything I've ever seen on the shelf.
And the calcium, if you're looking for a quick fix, it's not, bone meal or any of those calcium, that's not going to be quick. That's going to be...
Yeah, it's long-term. I'm not sure there's calcium in the same, like chelated iron. I've never seen it in a liquid form.
No.
But that's what Google's for.
Ed, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure. Ed Lyon directs the Allen Centennial Gardens on the University of Wisconsin-Madison campus. And it's always a pleasure to have him with us. And I hope you have a chance to get out to the gardens. As he said, the lilies right now are just a sight to behold. So get out there if you can. You get directions off my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. Take you right to the Allen Centennial Gardens on the UW-Madison campus. The weather guys join us on Monday. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.